This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, Samoa's first female Prime Minister takes office at last and tells us the budget and easing COVID-19 restrictions are first on her to-do list. The parents of an Iranian asylum seeker who was murdered while in detention in Papua New Guinea are suing the Australian government. And we look at how OFC plans to find a way to send an island team to the 2027 FIFA Women's World Cup. Those stories to come, but first, with the shadow of one of the world's worst COVID-19 outbreaks still hanging over the country, there was some light in the darkness for Fiji this week when their men's rugby sevens team struck gold for a second time at the Olympic Games. 5 years after winning the inaugural tournament in Rio, Fiji secured a second Olympic title with a comfortable 27-12 win over New Zealand in the final in Tokyo. Most of the players are back in Fiji now, but a celebratory party will have to wait until after 14 days of quarantine. In the meantime, the man who masterminded the team's success, coach Gareth Baber, has been reunited with his family in Wales. But he's told the Fiji Rugby Union he'll certainly be back.
I just want to say to all the people of Fiji, thank you very much for believing in us. Thank you very much for all your support for the players themselves. It's pretty much done for the people of Fiji and everything that you're going through at the moment. It's very much part of our foundation for what we did over these last 3 days. The players are good, a couple of injuries, but they're in good form, as you can imagine. We've got a few things to do, but I'll actually go back to the UK, so hopefully be back to Fiji in a few weeks' time. It's time I see my family, so I'm looking forward to going and seeing them after 7 months. But yeah, it's been a journey for certain. We've learned a lot. Players have developed, and some of the young players now are playing international rugby, whereas 6 months ago they couldn't have dreamed of it. So we're really proud of what we've achieved. I think that this is one to be remembered and savoured, and I'm looking forward to getting back to Fiji at some point in the future. We get a celebration all together. So thank you very much to everybody back there in Fiji. Thank you for your support and your love, and I'm looking forward to seeing you all again soon.
Gareth Baber's family had planned to be in Japan for the Games, so his wife Danielle says watching the final on TV in the UK was tough.
To have finally achieved this, it's surreal. You know, I was here with my own family. I've never been very good at watching it with a group of people. You know, the plan originally was to be in Tokyo, and obviously that plan had to be dropped. You know, so it was very special for us, you know, a lot of emotion. And the margins in sevens, it's a roller coaster, isn't it? You know, referee decisions go one way or the other. I had faith that they would do it, but for them to have actually achieved it. And for Gareth, I'm so happy. He rang us immediately from the stadium when they finished, and I haven't seen him smile so much for a long time. He's been under a lot of pressure. The boys have been away from their families for a long time, you know, since they went into lockdown.
And the victorious captain, Jerry Tuai, is now the only athlete from the Pacific Islands to have two gold medals in his possession. And as he already had one from Rio, he apparently offered his second to Gareth Baber. And speaking to FBC, Tuai has explained how his journey to the Olympics could have been very different if his coach hadn't persuaded his very homesick captain not to run away from camp during the pre-games build-up in Fiji.
I have three kids, so it's really hard for me. We have our ups and downs in camps. Coach knows. It's a long story. I nearly jumped camp. Because how I miss them, because we're really close. But that's why he's the coach. He dragged me inside the camp and he bind us together so we can continue the journey.
That's the victorious skipper of Fiji's Olympic gold medal winning rugby sevens team, Jerry Tuai. And congratulations to him and his teammates for a stellar performance at the Tokyo Olympics. The new Samoan cabinet met for the first time this week with Fiamei Naomi Mataafa presiding now that she has been recognised as her country's first female leader by the courts. Fiamei moved into the Prime Minister's office after her defeated opponent Tuilepa finally conceded more than 3 months after the country's general election. Now she and her government will focus their attention on getting Samoa's finances back on track, and they'll consider easing the restrictions that still exist under the country's long-standing COVID-19 state of emergency. But Fiamei says one of the new administration's first tasks will be to get the government workforce on side.
Although it's a normal process to have changes in government after elections, the HRPP has been in government in a straight line since 1988. So most of the country and most of the public servants know no other government than the HRPP. So one of the things that we have seen through the last few months going through the process is that, especially within the public sector, they're finding it very hard to differentiate between a party political representation versus the government function. This is a reality. We have to work through it. We have to build the confidence of the public servants back to holding neutral positions and carrying out their functions.
And what is the first order of business?
Our financial year concluded at the end of June. So we need to convene Parliament to pass a budget. We've instructed Treasury to prepare a 25% budget. This is sort of a transitionary emergency provision that's provided under the Constitution. It enables government operations to continue, but at the same time, too, for us as a new administration to have a bit of time to review the financial and economic situation and to look at a fuller budget. And especially, too, although Treasury has done the preparations of the budget as they normally do, what they need to understand is this is a new administration. We have platforms and we want to see that any budget starting from this year will reflect the priorities that we've determined under our platforms.
Regional and world leaders have extended their congratulations to you. I believe you've had a call with Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison and New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Moving forward, how will you, you know, negotiate and navigate and continue Samoa's working relationships with the region?
I don't see that there will be much difference. I'm very much advocate for regionalism. I'm concerned that the northern states indicated that they are withdrawing. I understand that there are efforts being made currently to repair that situation. I would very much support that and work towards ensuring that the region stays intact.
As we look globally, COVID-19 is still very much a big issue. What plans are underway in Samoa to potentially reopen the border with countries like New Zealand?
Yes, I mean, I think all countries are keen to reopen borders. We've always been mindful that the best approach is to keep our borders closed, given that our health infrastructure, as we saw during the measles, would not be able to cope with a spread of pandemic. So, you know, for a small country, I think that's still our best protection. But we're looking very carefully at bubbles that are being arranged, Cook Islands and New Zealand, for example, and of course, between New Zealand and Australia. Our own relationship with American Samoa, you know, being our closest neighbour, that's a bubble we could explore. The other thing that we are looking at, because we are under a state of emergency, is that although we might keep the borders closed, I think we need to review some of the emergency orders that are in place and are constraining people's ability to activate business and livelihoods. So I think that would be one of the things that we would start looking at very closely.
And what might that look like then?
Well, it's funny, you know how people make rules and then they don't follow through, you know, about gatherings and so forth. They're still in place and yet there's still gatherings. And so we just need to clear out the clutter and just really see, do we really need a state of emergency or can we operate under normal circumstances but still keep the borders closed, perhaps in the shorter term while we review that. But it's really freedom of people to be more mobile. There's a big issue about trading hours. So these are some of the things that I think we need to look at quickly.
VMA Naomi Mataafa, now officially Prime Minister of Samoa, and she was talking there to Marla Damadi. Well, supporters of a man who's facing extradition from Australia to Samoa are hoping the change of government there will lead to his release. Talalelepoonga has been in detention in Queensland for nearly a year after the previous Samoan government sought his extradition so he could face court over allegations of his involvement in a plot to assassinate the then Prime Minister, Tuilepa Selele Malielingoi. But as Liam Fox reports, now that Tuilepa is out of office, Mr. Poonga's supporters are hopeful that the case against him, which they say was politically motivated, will be dropped.
Talalelepoonga has been held in detention in Brisbane since August last year. That's when the Samoan Australian was arrested after the Samoan government asked Australia's Attorney General to extradite him to face a charge of conspiracy to murder. Friend and supporter Tracy Nelson says it's taking a toll on him and his family.
It's had a really straining on him and also his children, his whole family as well. They're all stressed out. They don't know what's happening as well.
Before his arrest and detention, Mr. Paonga was a vocal critic of the former, long-time Prime Minister Tuilaepa Sailele Malialengaoi. Back in 2018, he made headlines when he hurled abuse and a pig's head at Tuilaepa during a visit to a church in Queensland. Ms. Nelson believes the assassination allegation and the extradition attempt were politically motivated.
At the time, a lot of people were scared to voice their opinions against the Tuilaepa and the HRPP party. And this is what's happened. It was politically motivated, in my opinion. And this is all, that's why he's been extradited in this case.
Samoan police allege Mr. Paonga is one of four men involved in a plot to assassinate Tuilaepa in 2019, though few details have been publicly released. In Samoa, the three others have been charged with conspiracy to murder, an offence which carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. But now, Tuilaepa is no longer Prime Minister. After 22 years in power and a dramatic three-month political standoff following elections in April, he's been replaced by Fiame Naomi Mataafa and her new fast party government. Ms. Nelson hopes the new government will drop the case and extradition request against Mr. Paonga.
I'm very hopeful, and a lot of people are hopeful, and Sala is hopeful as well, that they will be reviewed and thrown out.
Mr. Paonga's extradition case has gone through court in Brisbane, and a magistrate has ruled he is eligible for extradition. His lawyer, Greg Finlayson, says they are challenging that process in the higher federal court. He says there's still some way to go in the extradition process before Mr. Paonga could potentially be sent to Samoa.
The Australian Attorney General has the final say in these matters, and it's a broad matter of discretion because the matters which have been alleged against our client are really matters that are said to have all occurred in Australia. Now, our client's never been approached by the Australian police about this. This is purely a matter that's emanated from the old government of Samoa.
Mr. Finlayson says the case has wider implications beyond Mr. Paonga's circumstances.
He's been subject to periods of isolation, so it's not an easy matter for anyone that's the subject of an extradition request in Australia. That's a matter of contention much more broadly than our client, that Australian citizens can be arrested on the allegation of a foreign government in Australia and put in jail until it's all sorted out.
The ABC approached Samoa's new government to see if it was considering dropping the case and the extradition request against Mr. Paonga. A spokesman said the government's first priority after months of political uncertainty is to organise a budget, but then it would be a matter that the new Justice Minister would look into.
Liam Fox reporting. I'm Richard Ewart and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. The family of an asylum seeker who was murdered while in detention in Papua New Guinea are suing the Australian government. Reza Barati was killed during a riot at the Australian-run processing centre on Manus Island 7 years ago. Karen Adams is the legal director at the Human Rights Law Centre in Melbourne, which is closely involved with the Barati family's case.
Reza was just 24 years old when he died. He was an Iranian asylum seeker who came to Australia seeking safety and was instead transferred to the Manus Island Detention Centre, where shortly after his transfer, he was brutally beaten to death by G4S guards and other contractors during a rampage by guards at the centre. His roommate saw a group of guards attack him as he was attempting to flee up some stairs, and one of the guards hit him over the head with a plank with a spike in it, and he was then kicked repeatedly until another contractor brought down a large rock on his head, which caused the brain injuries that caused his death. This was an appalling, brutal murder by the very people who were supposed to be caring for him, and there's been very little justice for it. So two local contractors were ultimately convicted of murdering him but were given reduced 5-year sentences on the basis that other expat guards also involved fled the country and couldn't be prosecuted. And a Senate inquiry here found that the violence that caused his death was eminently foreseeable and recommended payment of compensation to his family. And yet 7 years on, there has been no compensation paid for his death and no apology either from the Australian government or from G4S. And so this case really, on behalf of his parents, Farida and Torab, is about seeking justice for their son's death.
Now, by suing the Australian government and security operators, what grounds are they suing them with?
The claims are for wrongful death and also for the mental harm suffered by his parents as a result of the murder, which has left both of them deeply traumatised. So it's a claim for compensation, but I think for them it's much more than that. It's really a claim for justice. Their son was beaten to death by the very people meant to be protecting him and in circumstances that were eminently foreseeable. And I think that it's partly about them ensuring that their son's death isn't in vain, isn't insignificant.
Now, you did mention there the Australian Senate's inquiry. How important will those findings be in this particular case?
It's tricky to use the direct results of a Senate inquiry in legal proceedings, but similar evidence that form the basis of those conclusions by the Senate inquiry will be certainly used in this case. And I think there have been a number of cases now that have been brought in relation to this same incident, both on behalf of people injured in the violence and also on behalf of guards who were present at the time of the violence and were so traumatised by it that they themselves brought legal action.
It's believed to be the first time civil proceedings have been launched in Australia on behalf of a family of a person killed in offshore detention. What are their chances of winning?
Look, we believe they have a strong case, and while it's thought to be the first time that a case has been brought in relation to a death in offshore detention, there have been a number of cases brought by people injured or harmed in offshore detention. Most of those cases have settled before trial, but often with quite substantial settlements. And I think while our primary focus and concern is for getting justice for the Barati family, a case of this kind does have the potential to set important legal precedents as well. But I think even beyond the legal case, Reza's death has become symbolic of the brutality and impunity of Australia's offshore detention regime as a whole. And we still have 230 people on Manus Island and Nauru who are being held there. And over the course of the 8 years that this policy has been in place, there have been so many people that have been harmed and traumatised and failed by that system. And I think that this case in many ways highlights so many of those failings.
What are the next steps now? How long might it be for the family to have to wait for this to play out in the courts?
Well, we will now have to wait for both G4S and the Australian government to file defences. Usually that takes at least 30 days, but how long the litigation will take overall will depend a lot on how G4S and the Australian government respond to the claim and what legal points they choose to take to fight this case or if they take a more constructive approach to it. So we will have to see, but certainly the Barati family's already been waiting a long time and we hope they don't have to wait too much longer to receive justice.
That's Karen Adams, Legal Director of the Human Rights Law Centre in Melbourne, and she was speaking to Marla Damadi. And finally, for this edition of Pacific Review, the former coach of the Fijian men's soccer team, Christophe Gamel, has always said that in his opinion, a women's team from the Pacific would qualify for a FIFA World Cup long before the men. And now the Oceania Football Confederation is out to deliver on that prediction with a new strategy targeting the women's game right across the region and already hailed by FIFA President Gianni Infantino as historic.
Oceania Football Confederation is all in with its inaugural women's football strategy that will lay the foundations of achieving OFC's ambitious goal to qualify two teams for the FIFA Women's World Cup 2027.
So exactly how will the all-in strategy pan out? Emma Evans is OFC's women's football manager and she says there will be five pillars at the heart of it: visibility, education, performance, culture and participation.
We want to look at doing research to fully understand the barriers that girls and women in the Pacific face when it comes to playing football, working in football and retaining women in football as well. And then when we look at the visibility piece where we raise the awareness, it's really about highlighting and showcasing women in the game and what they're capable of. So while it covers every area, I guess each pillar has one particular program attached to it that will really drive and push from our end to make sure, especially in that first year, that we're sticking to what we've committed to.
Were OFC to succeed with their objective of getting two teams to a World Cup, the assumption right now is that one would almost certainly be New Zealand. Since Australia went off to join the Asian Confederation, the football ferns have dominated in the Pacific. But Emma Evans says one of the aims of All In is to close the gap.
You only need to look at teams like Papua New Guinea that have had so much success in a Pacific level and at the Pacific Games to realise that with the right structures and financial support in place, they could do really, really great things. And you look at the development that's happening in Fiji and Tahiti, and there is a real shift in focus to the women's game. And now being public about the fact that we want two teams at the World Cup, it's really given the member associations, I guess, that confidence to do the same and to really invest in the women's game.
And to help spread the message and hear what the players have to say, OFC have appointed a team of ambassadors, one from each full member country. Danger here for PNG, and Samoa have taken advantage. Torianne Lynn-Lewis makes it 7 in this tournament for her.
My coach, Paul Eiffel, pulled me aside and said that I was kind of nominated, I guess you could say, by the federation to be the ambassador. And he told me to have a think about how I would feel about that, because it could be potentially for 5 years. It's massive and it's a bit of an honour as well. I just want to do the best I can to grow the sport and assist in any way as I can. I'm currently coaching and I hope to continue to do that to really get behind OFC and get more girls and women into the game.
And Emma Evans says Torianne Lynn-Lewis, or TJ as she likes to be called, and her fellow ambassadors can help OFC to find out just where the obstacles lie for women and girls who don't just want to play the game, they want to keep on playing.
I think often we're all guilty of putting this blanket over an entire region where we say, oh, it's the cultural aspects, or there's barriers here that have a negative impact on girls and women. But actually having a deeper level of understanding as to what they are within each country, because they do differ, and then partnering with the right organisations to help us overcome them as well. You know, football can do wonderful things for contributing to social change and cultural change, but we need to make sure that we're equipped with the right expertise to do that as well, and that is much bigger than just football.
I am still learning as I go. My role as the ambassador at this point is to be a role model for girls and women, and I am the face of women's football for Samoa across the Oceania. So I guess if they asked me to travel or do a video, then I would be that person that does that.
So the target is 2 OFC teams at the 2027 World Cup, but with the next World Cup to be hosted by New Zealand and Australia in 2023, why not then?
I would love to see another team there, and I think we've got a really good chance with the amount of national leagues and domestic football that's happening currently. It's just about, you know, getting the Nations Cup underway and those international matches to put these national teams in the best possible position come the 10-team playoff tournament early 2023.
When New Zealand won hosting rights for 2023, it was assumed that the leading island nation from the OFC qualifying competition would join them in the World Cup finals. But FIFA had other ideas, and now that team will have to play off against a side from another part of the world to secure their spot. One view is that yet again, FIFA have moved the goalposts for OFC, but TJ is okay with that.
I wouldn't say that's harsh. I think that just the way that that's been rolled out, it does just introduce a new challenge, and with another Nations Cup for that, I think Samoa with the right preparation could be that team, but we're unsure about when that playoff may be and where it is logistically possible to even hold.
The whole picture, of course, as with most sports, is confused by COVID-19 and travel restrictions. But in the meantime, Emma Evans says there's actually been a positive spin-off for the domestic game.
Most of our member associations have been able to continue with domestic football, and what that's meant is usually where money is spent on travelling across the Pacific to play these international matches, they've really been able to focus it on their national leagues and ensuring girls and women, and especially at that elite level, are able to continue to play at least domestically. And for me, playing regular matches, regular training more often than before, that's a huge win for us, and they'll be much better prepared when they finally do get to travel internationally and play these matches than they have been before.
And when it comes to that prediction by Christoph Gammel during his time in Fiji, TJ is a believer.
I definitely agree with that. I think if they do invest in those 5 pillars that OFC are wanting to really focus on, I think they're going to do that really well, and it is going to fit the criteria for what they need to grow the sport and get to that next stepping stone, which is the World Cup.
Torianne Lynn-Lewis, Samoan soccer international and now OFC ambassador, rounding up this edition of Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. If you'd like to hear the programme on demand, then do subscribe to our podcast. I'm Richard Hewitt, and as always, thank you very much for listening.